Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. We have a great show for you today that combines New Mexico history and photography. Joining me is architectural historian Chris Wilson, who authored and edited a new 337-page coffee table-type book entitled The Plazas of New Mexico. Also in the studio is nationally renowned photographer Miguel Gander. Miguel contributed about 100 photos to the book to go along with nearly 100 archival photos. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Steve, great to be here.
Later in the show, I want to talk to you about some of the plazas that most of us really know well, those in Santa Fe, Albuquerque, Old Town, and Taos Pueblo. But Chris, I'd like to start with this question. Why this book? Why this interest in New Mexico's plazas?
Well, we love New Mexico history. We love New Mexico's cultures. You know, that's one part of it. But the other is we're facing real challenges of sustainability in our culture. And part of that will be technological innovations. But part of it is paying attention to the way people did things before the fossil fuel bubble, before we could turn our back on sustainability. Part of it is buildings that were climatically adapted and work efficiently. But the other thing is what makes communities sustainable. And one of the arguments that we make is having a public space that has everyday interactions of people, but also has public celebrations and rituals that bring people together, that confirm their shared values, their commitment to their communities. This has historically has been very important as we now try to re-urbanize, to try to make our cities a little bit denser, mix uses together, make things more attractive for pedestrians, tie those to mass transit, transit-oriented development. These are all directions we're going to be going. It's not just putting the functions and the pieces together, but we're probably going to need public spaces and forms of social and public interaction to reinforce this direction towards learning some of the lessons of the past of how to live more sustainably.
Miguel, if I can bring you into the conversation, I've looked at your work, including your prior work, and I have to say I really like it, but you don't strike me as an architectural photographer. So I'm just kind of wondering why you thought this was a good project for you, why you decided to do it.
Well, you know, I'm really about people, and most of the work in the book is about people. But one of the things, this project originally came out of architecture classes, and I traveled with the students. And we decided that we wanted a book that was not only a beautiful book dealing with history and place and sense of place, but we also decided that we needed a book that could be used as a textbook and to inform. And so we had these terrific illustrations and city plans, a lot of them done by Jose Zelaya, a lot of them done by the office of Steph Palazoides, that really freed me to be a photographer. Instead of dealing with a more traditional way of shooting architecture, I was able to just put people into the spaces, not just have them standing next to a building to see scale. So there was like a tremendous liberation in this. Probably my only concession to the idea of architecture photography is the use of a panoramic camera that enabled me to see space in a different way and try to deliver layers. I used a very wide-angle lens.
Almost all the photographs, you use that wide-angle lens.
Yeah, I use a wide-angle lens on a panoramic camera because these are about space and the human interaction of space. So there was this real freeing, because if somebody really wants to see what those spaces look like and the patterns, there's just terrific illustrations mm-hmm. to do that. So it's sort of to bring the plazas to life.
Yeah, Miguel is really a master of capturing the intimate frame of social interaction. You know, he's known for his photographs of lowriders where the camera eye is him leaning in at the window, at the driver's window, and seeing how people are interacting there. And so in these photographs, he's capturing, for instance, on the Santa Fe Plaza, you know, young kids.
They call them the Plaza Rats.
The Plaza
Rats.
Rats,
right.
And, you know, young.
I've seen them.
Yeah, and but the image has, you know, three gals that are together, and then their friends are the next social ring. And then there's the Plaza Monument, and then the Plaza Trees, and in the distance the Palace of the Governors. And so you go from the most intimate to the most public in one frame.
And I think you truly accomplished that, and we're going to talk about some specific photographs with Miguel later. But what I'd like to do is you talk about three plaza traditions in the book, and I'd like to sort of get started with the three traditions. You talk about the Pueblo, the Hispanic, and the Anglo. So let's start with the oldest tradition, and I'd like to start with the plaza that most of us are familiar with, and that's the Taos Pueblo Plaza. And I wonder if you could describe the plaza, Chris, and
sure.
I wonder if you could also describe the buildings that are around the plaza.
Yeah. Well, the Pueblo tradition is, you have to say, the oldest urban settlement tradition in the United States. And it's known in many places for compact plazas where ritual dances take place, circular kivas that are close by. And the Taos Plaza has those things, but it's in a phenomenal location where it's pushed up against the foothills of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. And the plaza is pulled apart to two great stepping pyramid buildings, the North Building and the South Building.
They're amazing buildings.
Yeah, and they're echoing what are, for the Taos Pueblo Indians, the sacred mountains from which their water emerges from Blue Lake in the mountains and comes down, and it's this broad, open, packed earthen plaza with the sacred water, wind, breath, with the life force flowing out of the mountains and as a stream flowing right through the middle of the plaza.
Now, how old are those buildings? Do you have any idea?
I think that the best archaeological surmise, so this would be Euro-Americans dating of the settlement, it's the early 1300s. And certainly Taos Pueblo Indians have been in that area longer. There's a nearby village that's referred to as Cornfields Pueblo. So I think as a community, they probably date from the 1100s and that location from the early 1300s.
And what are the buildings constructed out of?
They're constructed of adobe and then small tree log vigas and earthen roofs over the top of that. It's modular construction, so kind of smallish rectangular modules that are built one or two at a time by families, and they mass up and they build up, as I say, into this stepping 4 and 5 story tall sugar cubes, you know, stacked up into an echo of the surrounding mountains.
When I look at those buildings, I see the Pueblo Revival style or the Santa Fe style pretty clearly. Were they actually a basis for that?
Yeah, absolutely. That revival style that actually starts on the UNM campus, 1905 to 1909 period, and then quickly the development shifts to Santa Fe. The architects and
archaeologists. Yeah, we should mention your book, The Myth of Santa Fe, and I did a show with you on that a long time ago.
That's right, when that came out.
Right.
Tells the full story. But yes, they were basically looking at the pre-railroad, pre-industrial buildings of New Mexico. So that meant the Spanish mission churches. It meant the terraced Indian pueblos. Some of the major inspirations were things like the Acoma Mission, the church at Las Trompas, and above all, Taos Pueblo, and especially its north building and that great mass terraced step-back residential building.
Now, the plaza itself, how is it oriented and how does it compare with other Pueblo plazas?
Well, the Pueblo plazas are, as Rena Swensel, the great Santa Clara-born architect and intellectual, has argued, the Pueblo worldview is that we live in a sacred space that's made up of an earth bowl and a sky basket. And so for the Pueblos, there are 4 sacred mountains roughly at the compass points. The 2 other directions, up and down, connecting the underworld to the heavens, are the other 2 sacred directions. And in many pueblos, they're more rectangular, more confined spaces that are centered in this sacred earth ball and sky basket, this sphere. And what happened is at Taos, because there's the Rio Grande Gorge that's cut so deeply into the earth, the village can't be down by the Rio Grande, and so it migrated up towards the mountains. And you have that sense of relationship to the sacred landscape. In other pueblos, the village really recreates the sacred mountains in the 3 distances, but there it's pushed up against the mountains. And so that's why I'm saying the confined plaza is pulled apart by the power of the sacred mountains and the north and the south buildings pulled up in their direction and echoing that sacred landscape.
Now, Miguel, there's a wonderful photo, an archival photo in your book. I think it taken about 1920. And it basically, I wonder if you could describe it for me.
Okay, it's a photograph by T. Harmon Parkhurst, who is one of the great photographers who created a legacy in New Mexico.
It's a beautiful
photograph. And
right?
It's a picture of Taos across from the river. It's the North Pueblo, and you see the river, which is that sacred blood coming down from the sacred mountain in the foreground. You almost don't see the other side of the river, so that the bottom of the river is anchoring it as if it were on an ocean. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the spiritual impression. This is just a dominant space. And then what's really kind of remarkable is it later, I have a similar picture from a similar view in the book.
It does. Yeah,
and
you
see how little it's changed.
It's amazing.
And the changes are very subtle. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense of timelessness where my pictures add to this this dialogue with the place. The exciting thing about the book is
I completely agree. That's exactly the impression I got when I looked at your photo, the timelessness of it.
Yeah. One of the exciting things of working on a project is photography is always, for me, a dialogue about time. And my pictures just become a new marker for these extraordinary pictures. There's a picture by Jess Nussbaum of the Santa Fe Plaza, who's one of my heroes as a photographer who comes here culturally. And, you know, my images, which are all shot in black and white,
Why did you do that, Miguel?
There's a couple reasons I love black and white. Black and white allows, color can be very seductive, and it can be very much, you know, if something's red in an image, it can draw the eye away from different things. For me, on a personal level, black and white is more emotional. It's more timeless. It becomes part of a dialogue with those old photographs. To have a color picture in this book or of mine in the book, although I do shoot a lot in color, it just doesn't have the feel and the resonance. You know, I don't want to say this is a Miguel Gandert photo book and the color is very different from the rest of the book. This is about that communication with the past. And so therefore, I think that the formal qualities of the space are much better rendered in terms of the dynamics and the whole. I just love black and white. It's a timeless.
Yeah, Steve, I might just say that if the listeners want to see some of Miguel's photos as we continue to talk about them, they can go to the book website, plazasofnewmexico, that's one word, .com, plazasofnewmexico.com.
Great. Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Steven Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have in the studio the author and editor of a new book, The Plazas of New Mexico, Chris Wilson, and I'm very pleased to also have Miguel Gandert, a wonderful photographer who contributed to over 100 photos to this book. And I'd like to move on to the Santa Fe Plaza, Chris. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of the history of that plaza?
Well, sure. Santa Fe is founded probably in the spring of 1610. It was originally a large rectangular plaza that stretched a block further east than it does today. In the Pueblo Revolt of 1680, the Spanish colonists were driven out, and in fact, Pueblo Indians moved into Santa Fe and made it their own, made it into a multi-storied Pueblo village. That kind of reorganized the city, and that's really the genesis of the plaza shrinking down to its current square dimensions. Of course, that's where the Palace of the Governors, where the seat of government was, from 1610 until, I think it's 1886, when a new Capitol building is constructed. It's a pretty intimate plaza. It's about 280 feet in one direction and 300 feet in the other, for those of you that have a sense of dimensions. You know, a residential lot's about 150 feet deep in many places. It's surrounded by portales, the Spanish word porches, that are called for in the Spanish laws of the Indies, the town planning ordinances under which it was established. The Plaza Park dates to the early 1860s and is part of an international civic improvement movement that was active in Europe and Mexico, in the United States, of creating civic parks with a focal point. In this case, a monument at the center, radial walkways, perimeter promenade, benches, you know, where you can sit under the trees, but a relatively open space that works well for everyday informal interactions, and it works for the gathering of 2, 3, 4,000 people there on public occasions.
Now, I know very little about the law of the Indies, but the one thing I remember is that there's supposed to be a church on the plaza, and that church is about a block off the plaza.
Yeah, it was on that original rectangular plaza, and it was on the middle of the plaza. And then after the Pueblo Revolt, the Spanish came back, and they had to kind of fight to reestablish that square plaza. And that's when they relocated the church to the head of San Francisco Street. And so it's roughly where the original one was, but it was kind of adapting to the change.
So the church that we see in Santa Fe dates from approximately when?
That's from about 1700. So that's, you know, within 10 years of the return and reconquest of 1692-93, they start constructing that it was an adobe church in that location, the current one, the stone church of Archbishop Lamy, the French-born first Archbishop of New Mexico, was constructed around the adobe church starting in 1869.
Now, we alluded earlier to the Santa Fe style, and I get from this book that it was only after New Mexico got statehood that Santa Fe decides that they can venture forth on this Santa Fe style?
Well, yeah. I mean, as the territorial capital, they had to carry the campaign for statehood from 1846 or 1848 when New Mexico was annexed to the United States for 64 years until 1912. And they have to convince the rest of the country that the state has Americanized enough to be admitted to statehood. And so they emphasize the development of public institutions, of schools, of courts, of government, of commerce. And the way they projected that was by building contemporary buildings, neoclassical territorial capital and so forth, and then reproducing those in their promotional materials. And so they really had to embrace Americanism in that period leading up to statehood in 1912. Once statehood was granted, the city had been in economic decline because it was bypassed by the main line of the Santa Fe Railroad. And they said, what are we going to do to revive our economy? They established a city planning board who studied the problem, and they said, well, you know, tourists are filtering in here, but they're passing straight through because we've made our plaza look like Main Street Anywhere, Italianate business blocks and so forth. We need to seize tourism as our opportunity for economic development and remake the city in the Santa Fe style. And then, of course, they had to start, you know, had to say, well, what is that? And they started studying those older adobe, first Spanish buildings in town, and then they started looking at the Pueblo villages. And by about 1916, they've got a pretty clear definition of what they want to do.
And then that style radiates out from the plaza?
Yes, it does. You know, radiates out, you know, within Santa Fe. There was also already a stirring of the style on the UNM campus, so that's one island of it. And probably the heyday of the style is in the 1930s under the WPA, when there's a kind of an embrace of regional identity. So it's not only Taos, Santa Fe, Albuquerque's North Valley, UNM campus, but a lot of courthouses around the state are built in that style in that time. As far south as, say, Carlsbad has a great Santa Fe style or Spanish Pueblo Revival style courthouse.
Now, Miguel, there's some wonderful archival photographs of Santa Fe, and you can see in those photographs something of the Spanish style and the territorial style. But you see nothing that looks like the current plaza, right?
Well, I think you see details when you look really carefully into them. The details of what is now Santa Fe are there. Walking through the plaza in Santa Fe, the other editor of this book is a terrific new urbanist architect, Stefanos Palazoides. During one of the classes field trips years ago, really, you know, I grew up in Santa Fe, and suddenly there is a major architect describing the uniqueness of the Santa Fe Plaza as a space and a design. And he's comparing it favorably to the Rambla, which is probably one of the most famous civic spaces in all of Europe. And he's looking at Santa Fe a unique way. And if you really walk around the plaza and look at the different faces, from, you know, the really old face of the Palace of the Governors to, you know, on the kind of east side face where you see different architectural ideas. And then there's illustrations in the book that show that. I mean, the remarkable thing about the Santa Fe Plaza, it has in some ways remained intact to a degree that you can actually see these living layers of history now. So when you go back to the photographs, it's really kind of interesting.
It's
to look
to
at
look
the details.
At the Palace of the Governors then and
yeah,
now.
Yeah, then and now. And it's really pretty close. I mean, you know, it has to be repaired. It has to be restuccoed. But, you know, the walls underneath that, it's architecture is a living, breathing place, but it's not been so disrupted that it's completely different. It hasn't been Disneylandized when you really look at it.
Yeah, and that's a perfect jumping off point for one of these photos that I want to ask you about. This photo of the conquistadores in Santa Fe, and you know, we see old men dress up in these funny outfits, and sometimes they look silly and they don't seem to be taking it seriously. You capture, you know, a kind of a solemn event. I mean, this is a real celebration.
Well, it is a real celebration. I mean, the Santa Fe Fiesta is important to the identity. And the plaza becomes a symbol of so many different identities. And for the Hispano community of Santa Fe, you know, the fiesta, the myth or the reconquest after the Pueblo revolt of Don Diego de Vargas, the actual saint, that is supposedly, and I believe it to be true, the actual saint that came when they reconquered 12 years after 1680 and they come back to Santa Fe. You know, it's present, and that's an extraordinary thing.
You capture that in this photograph, and I guess probably you can't express in words how one does that, but I'll ask you anyway. How does one do that?
One of the most amazing things is I think New Mexico has a unique history in having some extraordinarily brilliant people that I was able to work with and know in Santa Fe, and they were Edward T. Hall, the great anthropologist, inventor of the field of intercultural communications, who very much wrote about place and distances and human. He called it a book called The Hidden Dimension. And a guy named John Brinksdorf Jackson, J.B. Jackson. Chris has the chair named after Dowd Chair at UNM, who was the great cultural geographer. He invented the field. And I got to work with both these people and knew them. And for me, it's about the proximity that one is able to get comfortably when one photographs. I'm always at the edge of like what I think of the crowd that's watching. I'm going to be kind of in front and trying to work intimately. The thing I love about wide-angle lenses, it puts you in the space and creates a more intimate depth to the space. So even though there's a wide view because of the wide-angle lenses that I'm using, I'm actually very close. And I think proxemics, which was a term Hall used, being close, feeling, you know, in there. One of the great photojournalists, Robert Capa, used to say, if your pictures aren't good, you're not close enough. And learning from that and then later reading Hall and about personal distances, I've tried to work in those distances. There's another picture Chris talked about, Santa Fe, of the kids on the plaza.
I'm
literally
picture.
Laying down on the ground within feet of them. I am present in their space.
You know, one of the great pleasures of working with Miguel on this and going out to community celebrations around the state was to watch him work and watch the way this guy with two or three cameras around his neck can approach people and without a word enlist them in what he's doing. You know, people kind of size him up, sometimes even just out of their peripheral vision. They understand what he's doing. His body language is not aggressive. He kind of pauses and makes sure that people are ready to have him in that frame. He goes to work. It's a kind of a dance between him and them. And I see him, and I've seen him work enough, and I've seen the results enough. I know that he's seeing what he thinks is important, what the important visual and symbolic components are. He's maneuvering. Sometimes you even see the people with him, you know, up on a bandstand, you know, the horn section, realizing he's moving for an image. And they'll turn a little bit. And he'll get this perfect composition, and he is a pure artist in what he's able to accomplish.
Well, let me just mention, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and today we're talking about a book called The Plazas of New Mexico, and with an author, Chris Wilson, and with the photographer for the book, Miguel Gandert. And just quickly on the Old Town Plaza, Chris, sometime after 1920 or so, Albuquerque begins to realize that Santa Fe is pretty successful with a style and adopts its own style, a similar style.
Certainly Santa Fe is the model, not only for the Santa Fe style, but for the development of historical fiestas, for the redevelopment of plazas. It applies to Taos, it applies to Albuquerque. And Albuquerque maybe thinks about it a little bit, but it's only really 1938 when Route 66, which had been running north-south through the valley, is reoriented and runs down Central Avenue, and there's a new Central Avenue bridge, and you start to have lots of tourists going right within a block of the plaza, that you start to have tourists in there. So there's a little bit of tourism development leading up to the First World War, but it's really the 1950s when Albuquerque and Santa Fe at the same time adopt formal design review ordinances. Albuquerque assesses its history, and they say in part, this is going to be Spanish style, but they also say Western Victorian style. And so they kind of bring the territorial style of white trim, neoclassical details, and of kind of gingerbread bandstand and so forth. So it's really kind of mid-1950s. The Albuquerque Plaza business community and political leaders define that style to make it into a more compelling tourism destination.
Now, Miguel, you guys tell a great story about a repair that's done on the church, and the church is primarily Hispanic. But the repair is not done in the way the Board of Review thinks it ought to be done.
Actually, Chris is probably the better one to
okay.
talk about
yeah.
that.
It's just yeah, and that's about 1980, if I remember properly. And the church maintenance person faces a problem with the adobes on the front of the church being undermined by water. And he goes ahead and puts, it's called permastone, it's kind of a cast pseudo-stone, which he's used to using in residential construction, as a wainscot on the first few feet up from the ground on the building, something that's quite common in Hispanic vernacular owner-built houses, say, in the South Valley. The Historic Design Review Board says, hey, wait a minute, you know, you didn't run this by us, and in fact, this violates the historical appearance of the building.
This quote from the Review Board is fantastic. They say, we have found ourselves in a position that we are trying to protect the culture of these people from them.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, phenomenally ethnocentric, you know, to say something like that, to assume that the preservation and the historicist sensibility is the only one.
It's also a myth.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, in fact, you could say there is an ongoing Hispanic vernacular building tradition that was being expressed in what the building superintendent of San Felipe Church was doing.
So I want to move really quickly to the last tradition, and that's the courthouse square. And you choose Portales as an example of that. And there's, of course, squares all over England. I lived in London, and I lived off a square.
Right.
But apparently there's a difference in the courthouse square in the United States from the courthouse square in
other
places.
Yeah, sure. And I think it's important. We think so much about Pueblo and Hispanic culture and history in New Mexico. The Anglo history is equally important. And, in fact, about the eastern third of the state and then some of the places where the rail lines came through, you have these Anglo-American courthouse squares. And you're quite right to say that there were urban squares in Europe that were open spaces. They were hard stone piazzas in Italy and Spain. They were residential squares in England. And the unique thing about the United States is that about 1800, as the county emerges as the grassroots level of local democracy, people chose to put their courthouses right in the middle of the square. That's something that's not done in Europe. And so the square, usually surrounded by business blocks and commercial stores and the lawyers and the realtors and the surveyors who have business in the courthouse recording their deeds, come together as a kind of urban ensemble of commerce, of business, and government.
I mean, you could say the Anglos are focused on commerce and business, and the Hispanics are focused on tradition and celebration.
Well, yeah.
And the Pueblo people are focused on their ceremonial.
Yeah, I think both the Pueblos and the Spanish are largely religious and residential spaces, and then there's a bit of a commercial trade element that comes in. But they're really places where you've got either a kiva or a church where the shared religion of the entire community is expressed in that public space.
And whereas in the Anglo courthouse square, we have business, law, commerce.
Right. And then the celebrations would be, of course, 4th of July celebrations, veteran celebrations at the veterans' memorials on the square. And then there's a form of Pioneer Day, of Frontier Day, which is a kind of recalling of the first settlers, but it's also cowboy music and poetry and riding horses. And in a sense, that whole ensemble of cowboy culture is Anglo-ethnic cultural expression.
Now, Miguel, there's a wonderful archival photograph of the Portales Courthouse. And you see the courthouse, and there's something, looks like some kind of derrick in front of it, and there's nothing around the courthouse.
Well, I mean, that would have been the way the space was defined. I mean, first you plant the building. building and then you build around it. You know, it's a similar way that the church was the focal point of so many New Mexico plazas. The thing I love about that photograph is it's a sort of shot over the back seat of a car.
Yeah, right.
I mean, some kind of Model A and things. I mean, the beauty of archival photographs is sometimes the smaller things that exists in them, the details, especially in a historic photograph. This very intimate picture of the seat of a car, on one hand, very seemingly very contemporary in its feel, but yet it's very much about the past.
And then you have a couple photographs of a celebration like the ones that Chris was describing.
Yeah, it was Frontier Days in Portales.
Exactly. So. And I swear, I feel like I'm there when I look at your photograph.
You know, for me, part of this is always about you know, the idea of a road trip. I mean, the beauty of being a photographer and doing the kind of work we were doing for this book is you have to be there. You know, whether it was Jose Zelaya doing his extraordinary drawings and the students that we took out on these trips or the trips that we made, you know, you have to be there. And the great thing about being there is you find the layers of people and how they use these spaces. And the camera enabled me in terms of these places to really become an intimate part of those relationships that exist. And that's what I think is so extraordinary, is we have intimate moments in this book, throughout this book, of different periods of time. But yet if we wanted to reconstruct with the drawings and the detailed work that's also been done in this book, you could recreate these places. And I think that's our long-term goal, is to look at the past, to find sustainable architecture and for the future. You know, it was a gift to work. It was a long haul to make the book, but it was a really an extraordinary gift, and I'm hoping that the people of New Mexico and people everywhere realize what a unique and extraordinary place we live
so
in.
So we're nearing the end of the show, Miguel, and I know both in this book and in your prior work, you think a lot and you look a lot at cultural identity. And typically, as minorities get accepted and absorbed into the majority culture, they lose cultural identity. They lose their interest in cultural identity. Now, New Mexico is a little bit unusual, I think, in that respect, because we're kind of a majority-minority state. So I'm wondering, where do you think cultural identity is headed in New Mexico?
I think it's strong. I think it's healthy. I think, you know, I go to pueblos and go to ceremonies that I'm not allowed to photograph, which I think is always great fun because I don't have to work. And I see them as strong as they've ever been. I see the Hispano communities changing, evolving with the large influx of Mexicans, in addition to the old Nuevo Mexicanos, families like mine that have been here for several hundred years, with new immigrants and creating a new vitality. And I think, you know, the Anglo culture, I mean, you go out to, you know, Portales for Frontier Days, and you've got, you know, one of the photographs in the book is of tractors in the parade. And we saw all these different vintage John Deere tractors. And yet a few blocks away, we were looking at lowrider cars. And so there's kind of a kind of possibility of fusion and communication here in New Mexico, where the past and the future are right in our faces a lot of the time. And I think that's what we're trying to say in this book. I think it's vital. I think they're all vital. And I think, you know, I worry less about culture changing too much.
When you go to these plazas and squares on their feast days, on their celebration days, and you see the mobilization of community and the kids who have had to go away for jobs or education, and they're living scattered throughout the Southwest, and they come back at least once a year, and that reconnects them, and they reassert their identity there. And I think the plazas, the squares, the celebrations are really essential to the ongoing identity and vitality of these communities and the cultures of New Mexico.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. I'd like to thank my two guests so much, Miguel Gandert, who is a UNM professor and also contributed about 100 photos to the book, Chris Wilson, who is an architectural historian. I would also like to thank my producer, John Burgund, my engineer, Joe Green. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this and other locally produced shows can be found at KUNM.org. Archives of my prior shows can be found at stephenspitz.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.